Hello, my Italian 90 chums. It's me, Mark Godfrey, host as usual for our daily look back at the greatest World Cup of them all. Can we say that officially yet? I don't know. We've got three games from June the 17th, 1990 to analyse today, with groups E and F simmering nicely. And a bit later, we're going to be talking about referees and the standards of officiating at the tournament. Same as it ever was, eh? On board today are a couple of Vincere newbies, although if you're a fan of 90s football, and I rather suspect you are, they won't be strangers. My first guest is Ash Rose. Are you well, Ash?
I'm very well, Mark. A pleasure to be here and discuss the greatest World Cup of them all.
Fantastic. Good man and well said. He's a chief cook and bottle washer at the brilliant Alive and Kicking podcast, which is dedicated to the 90s like very few others. And with Ash, I have one of his trusted accomplices, Matthew Crist, who when he isn't aiding and abetting on Alive and Kicking, writes for football for all manner of outlets, including Fansbet, The Sportsman and various others. Nice to have you on, Vincere, Matthew. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. Nice to be here with you both. It's an absolute pleasure.
Good man. And joining us for the second half of the podcast to talk about his colleagues taking charge of matches at Italia 90 is the hugely respected former FIFA referee, Keith Hackett. He is never short of a view on things, that's for sure. So, straight to the action then, chaps, and it's to Palermo and Group F for the tea time kickoff, which saw Jack Charlton's Irish motley crew, who had spoiled England's party in the first game, take on Egypt, who stunned most observers by taking a well-deserved point off European champions Holland in their opening group fixture. Searching the internet for highlights from this one proved to be a bit of a fruitless task, and I don't know about you, but I could not recall one single second of this terrible goalless draw. Did either of you two fare any better?
Not me. I kind of forgot about this game, to be honest, and there aren't many highlights online to try and jog your memory, are there really? I did find I think both the highlights I found are both like 1 minute and 53 seconds, which probably says it all that you need to know about the game, because there really was nothing. Brian Moore and Big Ron on comms, which I loved hearing Brian Moore's voice, but there's little to say about this game, which is surprising seeing as how well Ireland did in the first game, obviously against England. And as you say, Egypt sort of surprised everyone by taking point off Holland. But Egypt weren't very good in this game. Ireland weren't much better. Matthew, try and add more to that, mate.
No, well, you did about as much as I could do. I mean, I was like you. I was more excited about watching the commentary and listening to Brian Moore, which you think the amount of old football I watch, I'd be sick of him by now. But I don't think that's ever possible when it comes to Brian Moore. But I was trying to work out what I was doing when this game was being played, and it's a shame actually, because I haven't got my famous World Cup diary to hand, where I famously kept a World Cup diary during this whole tournament, and I used to note down everything that I was doing. So I must have been watching it, because I watched every game in that tournament, but it didn't jog any memories when we decided we were going to discuss this game at all. And watching the highlights back, certainly nothing came flooding back at all. But then having watched the minute and 10 seconds of highlights that I could find on YouTube, I'm not really surprised. But I don't know, maybe you're a bit harsh on Egypt. I mean, I suppose you've got to remember that they were the massive underdogs in this group and in this tournament. So I suppose having got a great point in their opening game, this would be seen as a huge point for them again. And I suppose they did weather a bit of an Irish storm, but
the goalie played well. I thought that he made Sherbert made some good saves, I thought, bearing in mind that they had some good talent in front of them. There was that one real good chance from Ray Houghton sort of midway through the second half. I think the only really, I don't think they'd call it clear cut, that at the near post the goalie saved it there, didn't he? I thought he had a good game, but possibly quite harsh on Egypt. But not knowing more of the game and not being able to see more of the game, it's quite hard to take into context if who played the better team there.
Well, you could quite, if we had 90 minutes of the game, I mean, would you be willing to sit and watch it and tell
you
us?
You know me, Matthew, 90s football, I'll take
it.
Yeah,
that's true, that's true.
Well, I mean, yeah, you could perhaps excuse Egypt based on their lack of quality and experience at this level, but Ireland certainly had good enough players in their side to be able to cut through Egypt's stubborn resistance. Houghton, who you've already mentioned, who missed one of the two chances I think you can find on YouTube. Steve Staunton, Andrew Townsend, Kevin Sheedy, and then you've got the goal scoring now of John Aldridge and Tony Cascarino. Probably fairly, Jack Charlton received some harsh criticism in the Irish media about his tactics for the game, their trademark long ball style, not going down too well with the commentators, such as the often outspoken Eamon Dunphy, who said he was ashamed to be Irish after watching this performance. I always imagined that the fans and media in Ireland were just happy enough to be at the World Cup for the first time. But it sounds from that, or maybe it's just Dunphy, that they expected a lot more from their team than what they got in this game against Egypt.
Yeah, this is a furore I never knew anything about, I'll be completely honest. I've watched a few YouTube clips of this, actually. It kind of exploded, this whole sort of war. It became war of words between Dunphy and Jack Charlton, because they really weren't happy with some of the criticism that he gave in the studio on Irish telly. There's some great clips of some classic 90s dodgy camera work in the studio from Irish telly from that time. And it escalated. There was a documentary, I think one of the YouTube clips from, about Jack Charlton's reign as Ireland manager, and there was some snippets there, some talking heads from Dunphy, Charlton, and there was, Kevin Moran and a couple other players. And it really did escalate. I think Charlton called him a little guy who writes for a small paper in Dublin and said that he didn't like him. He's a bitter little man, whereas Dunphy was embarrassed and ashamed. It really kind of escalated more than I was aware of, which I think is unfair, because considering that Jack Charlton had taken Ireland, you know, to their first World Cup, as far as they'd ever been, arguably the best Irish team there's ever been as well. Maybe 94 is an argument, but I don't know about you, Matthew. I wasn't really aware of this kind of major fallout that had happened.
No, nor was I. I mean, I was aware of what a character Dunphy can be and has been, and I think it's worth putting a bit of context into it. I mean, he's very much the sort of the Roy Keane of his day, wasn't he? I mean, and having spent quite a lot of time in Ireland some time ago, Dunphy was, to hear people have conversations about games they'd watched in the pub, I mean, it inevitably went back to what Dunphy had said about it, or what he had written about it in the paper. I mean, he was almost consistently slagging off teams and criticising players, and you know, I suppose that was seen as his job. But I mean, I did find a clip like you did, where they sort of almost clarified what he said, and that he didn't say he was ashamed to be Irish, and it was almost a bit of a misquotation, I think, wasn't it? I mean, they played the clip back where he didn't actually say he was ashamed to be Irish. He just said something like, I'd have been embarrassed if that was my team, or something like that. But he was obviously looking to dish out some criticism. I suppose the only context you can put it in, I mean, we look at Irish as being plucky and they made their first World Cup and everything, but I mean, only 2 years before that they had a pretty good European Championship that had seen them beat England and eventually go out to Holland. So maybe, you know, there was quite a bit of expectation going into this tournament that Ireland could do a lot, and they probably saw that group and thought they might get a result against England, and more likely they probably thought that Egypt was their banker, really, to get 3 points, and especially having got a point against England, a win there would have seen them through. So maybe that was disappointment and frustration coming out, and I think maybe we're being a little bit patronising to assume that Ireland would just be happy to be there, but especially on the back of a really good tournament 2 years before. But yeah, I think it was more of a case of frustration, whereas Ireland probably thought they would struggle against Holland, and having Egypt in their group was probably they'd probably assume they would get maximum points, and not doing so obviously opened the group wide up, as we know it went on to become. So maybe it was just frustration boiling over, I think. Well, either that or Mr. Dunphy just looking for an opportunity to lay the boot in, I think.
Mm. Would you say that you guys are the best Irish squad possibly that ever went to a tournament? Because you had like three Liverpool players there who were like champions at the time. Paul McGrath, who had gone on to be what, player of the year in England a couple of years later. Aldridge, who was playing in Spain. Tony Cascarino. For me, I think this was probably the best Irish. I mean, especially, no disrespect to the modern day teams, but they're far and away from this squad.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Ash, because I say everyone thinks of that 94 team, which it maybe captured the imagination more than any other Irish team, particularly this side of the Irish Sea, purely because there was no England team there for people to get excited about. So a lot of people got excited about Ireland, whereas I think in terms of technical ability and the players they had at their disposal, I think the 90 team was better. I mean, like you say, you had the likes of Whelan and Aldridge and Paul McGrath, and I mean, you had the nucleus of that brilliant Liverpool team of the late 80s, and a few others to throw into the mix as well. So I would say so. I think off the top of people's heads, they'd probably say romantically that the 94 team was better, but on paper, I think I would put the 90 team as better personally.
Yeah, absolutely agree with you there, Matthew. I think a lot of Ireland's key players, although many of them were still hanging around in 1994. I think they were probably at their best between 88 and 90. So when you're talking about the likes of Whelan, Sheedy, Aldridge, Staunton even, although he, you know, mm-hmm. he played for a lot longer, but I think that his better years, or certainly his more incisive years, came earlier in his career. So yeah, I think and we had Kevin Sheedy on earlier in the series, and I asked him the question whether the players themselves felt hampered by the instructions they were given by Jack Charlton, and he was very diplomatic about how he answered that you know, you need a blend in the team, and we have this style that worked. So it seems from Sheedy at least that they were happy that they didn't quite use the skills that they had to their benefit, but they used them in a different way, and that's, you know, it was obviously something that bore success for them.
Yeah, I think they had Paddy Bonner as well, who I really, he's a big memory for me of that tournament, obviously with the penalty saves later on against Romania, but I just remember him being, have a great tournament as well, and being a great key, possibly underrated this side of the border. But I also had the Tonka figure of Paddy Bonner as well when he was playing for Celtic, so I've still got that sitting on my shelf, and that always reminds me of this Irish team who I really liked watching them. I think it was unfair to call them a long ball team or whatever that Dunphy went on about on that TV show, because I thought they did really well in this tournament.
I think when we talk about long ball teams, I think it's easy to forget that a lot of football was long ball then. I mean, even the great teams, I mean, I waxed lyrical about that Liverpool team of 88, and they were brilliant, but I mean, a lot of football was gimmick to the keeper, and you know, even those, that Liverpool team, quite often it would go back to the keeper, who could pick it up, and Groblar in this case, you know, would kick it long. Arsenal would kick it long. United weren't that great back then, but they would kick it long. But a lot of teams would play that way, and it's easy to look back now in an era where tippy-tappy football is the norm to assume that it was unusual then. I think long goal kicks and crosses into the box were of that time, and not so much now. I mean, we don't very rarely see crosses into the box and headers and
especially when you've got Tony Cascarino and Noel Quinn in the squad, you're going to naturally put balls into the box, aren't you? Those strikers are kind of a dying art in modern day football, so that is what you played to in 1990.
Yeah. So it was an instantly forgettable 0-0, which left Group F on a knife edge for all four countries, who had the same points and goal difference going into the final two group matches, and all manner of possibilities still remained. A double header now in Group E, with both games kicking off at the same time in the evening. We'll start with Belgium 3, Uruguay 1 in the Stadio Marc Antonio Bentegodi. Oh, I love saying that. In Verona, this was a game that turned out to be one of the most entertaining of the whole tournament. A decent start for both nations in their openers. Uruguay earning a point with Spain, while Belgium dealt efficiently with South Korea. The Belgians were two up inside the first quarter of this game, and just like the Korean game, they scored a couple of forgotten belters, lads.
Yeah, they did, well, yeah. We were just discussing them before, weren't we? I kind of forgot about them. And you, Matthew?
Yeah, I was going to steal your thunder there and say, it's the, well, we all agreed on this. It was very much the forgotten group for myself, and it turns out for you guys as well. And I'm not quite sure why, because looking at the teams in the group and the results that we now know happened, I mean, there were some belting teams in there and some great games. So I'm not quite sure from a sort of neutral point of view why it wasn't looked upon as a not necessarily a group of death, but I mean, these teams, you know, Belgium had made the semi-final 4 years before at Mexico 86, so very much a respected team. Uruguay were always looked upon as a threat. I mean, you got players like Francescoli, who was an absolute star at the time, Ruben Sosa. I mean, if this group had come out today, I think everyone would absolutely think it was the group, the actual pick of the tournament. But for some reason, a lot of us don't seem to remember it. But like Mark said, this game had plenty of great goals and top players in it. So it was a joy to watch it back all these years on, because I probably hadn't actually watched it since it happened at the time.
Uruguay, because they're sort of perennial World Cup, like they always reach the finals, don't they? But I had kind of sort of swept them under the carpet a little bit with Italia 90. It's not a tournament I kind of associate with, and you kind of forget because they didn't get, obviously they went out in the next round in the knockout where they got some knockouts, but this was, they were, as you say, a very entertaining team. Belgium probably unfairly are best remembered for getting knocked out by England and that amazing David Platt goal that I'm sure you'll wax lyrical about in future shows. So yeah, I think it's possibly forgotten because of what happened next, and especially in this country where we lead with the England story as well. So yeah, but there's some cracking goals in this, and some players that you've kind of know, you remember, but probably didn't fulfill the potential that around at the time. I know we're going to go and talk about Enzo Schieffer, who is somebody who at this point was really seen as someone who could go on and do things. I know, Mark, you wanted to express that point, didn't you?
Yeah, just on Schieffer, I mean, the goals, by the way, again, check them out on YouTube because they are crackers. The first one came from Leigh Clijsters, who, as we mentioned on a previous show, is the father of Kim Clijsters, the tennis player. And Schieffer, and I remember Schieffer, I remember getting, it wasn't Panini, but it was a sticker, they weren't stickers, they were like flexi plastic see-through cards.
And I know exactly what you mean.
I can't remember the name of them, but they came out around 84, I would guess. And it was like an All-Stars team, and it had Maradona and Zico. And there were players that I'd seen on the telly at the 82 World Cup, which is the first World Cup I remember when I was only about 6 or 7. But then there was this guy called Enzo Schieffer, this swarthy-looking, you know, sort of olive skin, dark hair. And he was about 16 or 18 at the time, wasn't he, when around sort of 84, 86. And he always had this huge reputation. And, you know, at major tournaments, and then when you subsequently saw him playing for the likes of Torino, and I think, did he go and play on for Inter, maybe? But certainly
Inter played, earlier in his career, I think.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, he played in Serie A for sure. And you would always watch him, or I was always watching him, trying to figure out what it was that had earned him such a big reputation. And I always wonder whether he ever fulfilled his potential, because he never played for, okay, there was that period at Inter, but he never had a sustained period at any of the real giants of European football at the time. And I wonder if he was one of those players who got to maybe 18 years old and had a supreme amount of talent for one so young, but then never really kicked on, or whether I just never got it at the time. And or maybe he was a player ahead of his time. He was the sort of player who might be better in this day and age.
I think it comes down to youth, because I mean he started off, he made his senior debut in 84 against Hungary, and then he went on to play in the Euros of that year, and was he was 18 years and 115 days according to my notes, and the youngest player ever to appear in the finals at the time. And I always think from experience, when players, I suppose Maradona would be the alternative view on that, but quite often when a player comes into a tournament is the youngest ever or the youngest that country has ever fielded, there's so much expectation around them that they sort of, the only way is down, so to speak. And that's probably a bit harsh for Schieffer, but I think from my point of view that's the reason why we sort of felt that he didn't go on to do as much as we thought he would, purely because so much expectation was put on his shoulders at such a young age. Because I mean, there's so many players that we could note that have come into tournaments, and you know, I mean, Whiteside in 82 was, you know, 17. I mean, don't get me wrong, Whiteside was a great player and a great servant for United and Everton and what have you in Northern Ireland. But quite often these players come in and are regarded as the next Pelé or what have you, don't deliver, purely because of the expectation on their shoulders. And whether that's a psychological thing or it's just the press, us not being able to accept that a player can't get any better than they already are. We always expect players are going to come into the game at 18 and by the time they're 28 they're going to be even better, and maybe that doesn't always happen with players. I just think that might be the reason that we feel he didn't fulfil his potential, even though looking back at his career he had a pretty, pretty impressive career. I mean, like Ash says, there is Anderlecht, Inter, Bordeaux, Auxerre, Torino, Monaco. You know, I mean, it was a decent career. I suppose what was missing there is a Real Madrid or a Barcelona, isn't it?
That's an elite team, as they're called in these days, aren't they? And he wasn't apparently nicknamed Little Pelé as well, as many people have been in the past. But I do also pick up on your point, Mark. I do think he might have been slightly ahead of his time because he was a very technical player, and whereas obviously we've already mentioned tiki-taki as well and playing out from the back, and in modern day football I think where you've got that tiny bit more time, obviously the defensive tackling is much more lenient than it is that it was in this sort of era. I think he might have flourished slightly more, especially in a Belgian team that is now are much better than the Belgian team of this era. They were a decent team. Obviously now, at the moment, you know, they're ranked as one of the top teams in the world. So I think he may have been a little bit ahead of his time, but I think also it was just a cluttered area. There were so many good attacking midfielders in this era, in this World Cup, especially going into 94 as well, when I always think it was just, you know, your Jihadis and your Stoichkovs in that kind of vein. You kind of think he may have got a little bit lost, whereas Belgium didn't really kick on themselves, so he might have got a lost on the European stage a little bit.
Yeah, I think as somebody mentioned in a previous episode, Italia 90, perhaps more than any other, was the tournament of the number 10s when you think about people like Schifo, Mateus, Valderrama, Maradona,
Baggio, yeah,
etc. Gascoigne, I suppose, you could throw into the mix in that,
completely,
that sort,
yeah,
of player. So it's understandable perhaps that Schifo didn't, you know, stand out singularly, because there were just so many great players at Italia 90 and around that era who played in the same position. Obviously Belgium, we've said, took an early 2-goal lead, but then they hampered themselves a little bit when Eric Gerrits took 2 quick-fire yellow cards before half-time. And then just after the break, veteran skipper Jan Koolemans secured the win with a third. Not Uruguay's finest defensive moment in their history, if you watch that back on YouTube. They did get a consolation, however, through substitute Pablo Bengochea, 15 minutes from time. But the 10 men of Belgium held out. They looked very tidy and dangerous for whoever was going to get them in the knockout phase, and we all know who that's going to be, and what a game that was. And Uruguay, they have their chance to qualify as one of the 4 best third place teams with a win in their final game over South Korea. I think we talked about it a little bit already. Belgium, decent. Uruguay, fairly anonymous. Would that succinctly sum them up for Italia 90, do you think?
I think, again, without wanting to keep referring back to the tournament that happened before that, but anyone that knows me knows I love any reference to 80s football, but you remember how poor Uruguay were and how dirty they were seen to be in Mexico 86. I mean, people just assumed they were a bunch of cloggers, that all they could do was go around kicking people off the park, which they tried to do, particularly against Scotland, I seem to remember. So I think there was a massive improvement from 4 years on, and if you look at the players they've got available to them, and I mean, I wouldn't say they made strides, but they, from the limited action I've watched back researching for this chat, they do seem to be have improved a lot more from the team they were 4 years ago, which maybe you could say was the opposite of Belgium, because, you know, we know Belgium got to the semi-finals in 86 and were beaten by pretty much single-handedly by Maradona, and I think a lot of people maybe thought that Belgium would be another dark horse, or was that Spain? There's always a dark horse in there, but so maybe Belgium was seen as the dark horse of 1990, and that was never the case. So you almost had two teams going in different directions, I think, when you look at those two particularly.
They also had two teams that ran into kind of the two stories of Italia 90 in the next round, didn't they? Also, Uruguay would go on to play Italy, who at home played very well. One of the stars on the tournament was Scalacci and Baggio, etc. And then Belgium, which we've already alluded to, played England, who were creating their own story of their own at that point with Gazza and everything. So in a way, they were slightly unlucky that they kind of faced momentum in a way with England and Italy.
It's fine margins as well, because, you know, we kind of brush aside Belgium. I mean, that could have so easily gone to penalties, and we all know what probably would have happened if it had gone to penalties. And then Belgium could well have made it 2 successive World Cup semi-finals. I mean, I remember when England faced Belgium, when the draw, you know, when the draw was made, or when it was confirmed who they were playing, I don't remember anyone being worried. I don't know about you, Ash, but it was almost like, oh, we got Belgium. Whereas really, you think about it, that would be, now if England drew Belgium in a major tournament, and if they got to the semi-final in the previous World Cup, you'd think, well, that's a tough game. But it almost seemed like England had dodged a bullet. But really, in hindsight, knowing what we know about that Belgian team and the players they had, it was almost it's probably a bit unfair on them, really, and they could have been the team that were facing Germany in the semi-final, and even getting through and playing Argentina in the final, who they lost to in 4 years before. So it's sliding door moments, really, I think, as all tournaments are, I suppose.
Well, I don't want to talk too much about the England-Belgium game, because I'm sure Mark will cover it in a future pod, but England weren't great in that game either.
No. Hit the post.
Yeah, hit inside of the post. So they were very lucky. I mean, Platt's goal was obviously 1 in a million, but as I'm sure guys will talk about in the future, it was a much closer game than anyone remembers.
And to round off the recaps, we scoot over to the other Group E clash of June 17th as South Korea, needing something to have any feasible chance of staying in the competition, took on perennial underachievers Spain in Udine. Barcelona hitman Julio Salinas was brought into the starting 11 by coach Luis Suarez, but it was a game that belonged to one man.
Michel hat-trick. I'm the number one, he says, and so he is too.
Some pretty understated commentary there by the BBC's Gerald Sinstat, considering Spain's Michel completed a brilliant hat-trick. Talk us through his goals, guys.
Yeah, I think the first thing you pick up on there is Gerald Sinstat. When I was watching this back, he really seems quite sort of relaxed and nonchalant about the fact that Michel has just scored a hat-trick in a World Cup, which is quite amusing. I don't know, because Gerald Sinstat's another great commentary era, so I'm not sure why he doesn't get too excited about that, because there's three great goals as well. I know in your notes you sent to us, you described it as Bergkamp-esque, the first goal, and although I'm a massive, massive Dennis Bergkamp fan, as people know from Alive and Kicking, I can kind of agree in where you're coming from. It was a nicely corner of the box, nice volley, one touch, and then into the bottom corner. And then, yeah, obviously the free kick, and then the last one, he danced around the defenders. I mean, three very different goals, showed very different types of skills and talent. Again, another player, very underrated, I think, Mikel from that era. So, yeah, I mean, it was a great hat-trick. One of those, when people look back at great hat-tricks, this one's never discussed, and I'd argue it's one of the best I've seen, especially of that decade and of that tournament football as well.
Mm. Michel, he was considered one of Europe's most gifted midfielders around that time, and he certainly had an eye for goal for Spain and Real Madrid. Do you think he suffered from being in a Spanish team that had talent but just lacked application? I mean, when you look at the top players of that time, he was right up there with all of them, but his name kind of just doesn't get mentioned, does it?
Yeah, I think when I was sort of doing the research, I mean one thing I will say before I go on is I wondered whether Gerald Sinstat had done that commentary after the game. I wonder why that was so nonchalant about it. I mean, quite often you can tell when this used to happen a lot back then, isn't it? I mean, now every game's covered and every game's live, but I think quite often back then, obviously if there was a big game on that day, the second game, as it were, would often be just put on the end of the highlight show, and they'd have probably got Gerald in a studio somewhere in Soho to put the commentary over the top. I mean, I might be wrong, but I just thought that might be the reason. But I thought the same thing when we were talking about Michel. I mean, he was another one of those names, a bit like, you know, probably a better name or more impressive player than Schifo, but again, a sort of a name at the time that we all thought was possibly better than they were. But again, I thought he was let down by the fact that he often played in a Spain team that were perennial jokers, really. I mean, which they were right up until, what was it, 2008, when they won the their first tournament. Was it 2010? Right up until then, people would always sort of laugh at Spain for being these guys that would had all these great names and would never achieve anything. And I think he was one of the names that suffered from that. I mean, from his club career and everything you read about him and everything you look back and see that he achieved, great player, but it was almost diminished by the fact that he didn't play in a World Cup winning team or a European Championship winning team, which again is incredibly harsh because it's not necessarily his fault, and we all know players that we can name now that could well be the case. But I think that's where I'd say he lost out, really, but unfairly, in my opinion, because as this hat-trick proved, I mean, he was a heck of a player, and it was almost the perfect hat-trick, really, wasn't it? I mean, you sort of, I think the well-taken goal and then the good finish and then the left-foot strike at the end, so and a free kick into the inside of the net. So, I mean, it was a beautiful hat-trick from a great player, but a player that sort of is lost in time of that era, really, I think.
I think also because we didn't see the Spanish league on a weekly basis, or we had social media to show us every goal that scored in every second, I think he kind of gets that era of Real Madrid because they were so dominant in the 80s. You think Mikel won like six La Ligas in his time at Real Madrid. He's over 400 appearances for them. He is one of their, of that era, one of their better players. And I think because we didn't see them week in, week out, appreciate what they do, I think maybe that sort of those players kind of get lost in the ethos of time.
I agree, because when I was looking back at the, just to jog my memory about what he'd done and who he'd played for, you do think, wow, if this guy was playing now, every kid in the school playground would know who he was. And I mean, you guys both remember that. You know, back then, you would have to be some kind of geek or nerd to really know who these guys were. You'd remember the name would come up every now and again, or you'd feature if an English team played them in Europe, which was rare, but in this era, because they weren't allowed to. But you know, it was these players are almost. They could probably walk down a high street, no one would know who they were. Whereas now, it's the complete opposite. I mean, everybody knows these guys. You know, they know the whole Madrid team, they know the whole Spain team. Whereas back then, it was a bit of a lottery. So, just because they erased some of our memories, I mean, it's a bit unfair, probably, to accuse him of being not living up to expectation. Because in terms of his domestic career and what he could do on the pitch, he was up there with everyone at that time, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's irony of a Toto Scarlatti, isn't it? Because he's now the sort of stable bearer of that kind of player that you don't get anymore, coming out of nowhere, taking a tournament by storm. We've lost that feeling, because we know pretty much, it's very rare, maybe you get a youngster come from nowhere, but we don't get that Toto Scarlatti feeling anymore, because we're just so aware of every player on every league.
Yeah, and I think we may have discussed this on a AK90s podcast, Ash. I think we said that this World Cup was probably the last World Cup where you got that, because by the time 94 rolled around, the Premier League had sort of been around for a couple of years and people were getting a little bit more au fait with football, and you had the Italian football was on Channel 4 not long after that, so people were starting to have pub conversations or school playground conversations about these guys. Whereas in 1990 you had really no way, unless you'd gone on holiday and seen one of these guys play in Spain or Italy or what have you, they were basically, they may as well have been from another planet. So and this was a prime example of that, I think, with Michel.
As good as all three of Michel's finishes were, and go and enjoy them on YouTube, perhaps the best goal of the night was actually Korea's first half equaliser by Hwang Bo Kwan. A 30-yarder, he couldn't have hit any sweeter from a short free kick, which left Zubizarreta, even from that distance, grasping at thin air. I'm getting sick of saying how many great goals are forgotten from Italia 90, but this is yet another one.
Yeah, it was a peach as well. I mean, and from his reaction, it almost looked, you could almost tell that he didn't expect it to go in, because he looked as stunned as everyone else. But the group itself had a heck of a lot of these sort of thunderbuster goals, didn't they? I mean, watching it back, and I was thinking, I'm not a tactical genius by any means, but I was thinking, is it something to do with the way the teams defended back then? You seem to have these epic sort of runs and long shots from about 30 yards out that went right into the corner, and I was thinking, is it because teams defend deeper or what? I mean from that, off the top of my head, in that tournament there seemed to be a load of these sort of goals. I remember Germany,
Mateus goal,
he put a couple in. I think they beat
Yugoslavia, is that the game?
And they had another whipping boy in their group, and I think they put five past them,
the UAE,
a couple of UAE, that was it, and a couple of goals that night were thundered into the bottom corner or 30 yarders, which he did. It seems to, a bit like diving headers, they seem to have gone out of the game somewhat. There seems to be a lot more play around the edge of the box now, defenders sort of holding their line, whereas good World Cups back then, again, I mentioned the 86 World Cup, but I remember the USSR team thundering shots in from 30 odd yards, and the Hungary team and the Bulgarian guys, they always seemed to have these players that were capable of smacking the ball from seemingly impossible distances and finding the back of the net.
I've got a friend, we've discussed this actually quite a few times, and we've kind of come to a conclusion, rightly or wrongly, that the ball has got a lot to do with it. And they keep messing around with the ball for every World Cup. And if you remember the 2010 World Cup in South Africa,
Jubilani,
it was like one of the penny floaters. You basically looked at the ball and it flew off into the air somewhere. So, I think that the footballs back then probably had something to do with it, meaning that you're shooting from range. Was you were more confident that it wouldn't balloon up into the stands, but again, also because you were probably more confident that if you got the ball on target, or if you hit the ball in the sweet spot, so to speak, that you had a good chance of keeping it down and therefore making the goalkeeper work, which encouraged attackers to shoot more from distance. Whereas these days, perhaps they aren't quite so keen to hit the ball from distance, but also tactically. A lot of football teams, certainly the elite level, international and Premier League, Champions League and so on, they are, I think they're brainwashed into trying to walk the ball into the net, where, again, 30, 35 years ago, I think many more teams were encouraged to shoot early for what tactically, and maybe because they just had more confidence in the ball being able to, to keep a true line.
Yeah, I think it's. I think it might be more tactical, because I remember that. Well, every World Cup that comes around, they seem to go on about the ball and how it flies around, and they always seem to mention how it will cause trouble for the keeper. So in a way, you think that the more they mess around with the ball, the more of these long shots you'd see. So I mean, maybe. But then again, maybe you're right. Maybe if you hit a harder ball, well, you're going to get a more of a direct.
Well, I think it's a heavier ball, isn't it?
Truer shot. Yeah, but I think it's more. It just seems to be me more to do with tactical awareness and just fashions in football. Because when you watch a game now at the highest level, you'd very rarely see players running at defences like you see in this group particularly. From every side, they all, apart from Ireland, from, as we discussed, but they all seem to have a player that would pick the ball up from the halfway line or the centre spot and run 30 odd yards and not be afraid of having a shot because there was hardly anyone in front of them, whereas now there would be, you know, a couple of holding midfielders and, you know, probably a line of defenders across the edge of the box. Maybe I'm just being sentimental, but it did stand out to me when I was watching a lot of these goals. I thought, wow, you know, they've been given so much time there to run and then pick a spot and hit it, and then hit it well, because these goals weren't flukes. I mean, they pick out the top corner, as you know, as the old saying goes.
That's what I was surprised with these goals, because the free kick is the same as well. The final goal is they get top bins, like proper postage stamp top corner, and I think that's no goalkeeper could have saved those. They're not just, you know, some of these sort of thunder shots can be lucky because the goalkeeper's in the wrong position. These are unsavable, especially this one. I haven't watched it again. I proper out loud went, whoa, from Kwan, because it is one hell of a strike as well. I'd forgotten about it. I wonder if he's sort of lauded in career like the way this Saudi Arabian guy is for his 94 goal as well, because there's the sort of moments these sort of minnow nations sort of live on forever, don't they? Because I hope he is, because it's one hell of a hit. And just on the balls, working for a football magazine like for Kick, every year they seem to get rounder is the term, which just baffles me. How can a ball get rounder at every tournament? It's a ball. So I mean, I don't know if that's the difference now. The Euro ball hasn't really been talked about that much, but the Jubilati that Mark mentioned, that was meant to be the roundest ball ever, but it just turned out, as you say, the lightest and most annoying ball that the World Cup's seen. But I do think the ball may have something to do with it here, and I think you can hit it much harder and get it much more away from a goalkeeper into that top corner.
So had Spain woken up at last, or was it yet another false dawn? Well, we know the answer, of course. It would be another two decades before they finally fulfilled the promise they so often had at major tournaments. Italia 90 was something of a watershed moment in terms of how FIFA wanted the game to be played and officiated in order to make it a more entertaining product for the coming satellite TV age. This was also undoubtedly with a view to the 1994 World Cup finals being held in the USA, where all manner of ideas were put forward, including increasing the size of the goalposts, would you believe, to make sure that football or soccer would conquer its final frontier. Vital to all of this, of course, were the referees and linesmen, and their interpretation and applications of existing laws, and, subsequently, some significant changes to others. So, to discuss this with greater insight, Matthew, Ash and myself have been joined by Keith Hackett, the esteemed former FIFA referee from England, who was at the pinnacle of his career around 1990. Thanks for joining us, Keith. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Delighted to join you.
Cool. You were one of a number of top English referees on the FIFA list around that time, and you'd participated at Euro 88 in West Germany, but sadly you didn't make the cut for Italia 90. Can you tell our listeners what prevented you from taking part?
Yes, I was shortlisted. I was expecting to go, but that particular lead up to it, I'd had a niddle, Achilles tendon injury, and I decided to take, on physio advice, about 7 weeks off in order to get full recovery of it. And sadly, I was then back and refereeing, and I remember the day well when I was expecting a phone call to be appointed. When I did get a phone call, I was on my way to referee at Anfield on a Wednesday evening, and the call came, and it was George Courtney's been appointed to the FIFA World Cup. You can imagine my disappointment. And it was something that I've been looking forward to, but nonetheless, I then got the other side of Manchester. My family phoned me to say they'd heard it on the radio. Was I okay? And I said yes. And then stepped out at Anfield and refereed a football match. And, you know, I think referees do at times face adversity. This was one that I remember as a negative rather than a positive.
Mm. Well, despite the disappointment, I'm sure you were a keen observer of the 1990 World Cup and how your colleagues kept order in the face of some very testing conditions. Before we get into how the application of the laws started changing back then, if we look back at the late 1980s, what were the most difficult hurdles to having entertaining, flowing and fair football games, especially at international level and at major tournaments like the World Cup?
I think to some degree there was an element of variable countries applying the laws in different ways. And I think referees themselves interpreting the laws in different ways. So we had certain countries being prepared to duck and dive, which was almost laughable. And then you had, you know, the aggression, if you like, putting it bluntly, of teams like Argentina and some of the Eastern Bloc countries, really prepared to put players out of the game. And I think FIFA recognised that they needed to do something about it. The outcome, interestingly, was that when you look back, many people in the game would regard Italia 19 as a bit of a poor tournament, in fact, rather than a good one.
Were there any memos or dossiers outlining how games should be handled passed around the refereeing fraternity in the build-up to Italia 90 that you can remember? And if so, what were FIFA's instructions, direct instructions to officials?
I think they really wanted fair play. I think they wanted referees to be tough. I think they were concerned about some of the violence in the game, and therefore I think the old adage was that they wanted referees to be much tougher in terms of their application of law. As a result of that, I think referees became quite defensive. I think we saw less application of advantage, and as a result of that, I think that affected what was then, if I remember, a fairly poor goal count. I think they sort of said the average was 2.2 per game, which they considered to be poor by FIFA standards.
Did you agree with the way that they wanted the laws to be implemented for that World Cup and thereafter?
Do you know, one of the things that I'm really against as a referee is the fact that we come up to a World Cup final. There's been many games played leading up to that final, and then all of a sudden they decide either they're going to change the law or they're going to clamp down, or referees are going to operate in a different manner. And I think that's really sad, because it impacts on the game, it impacts on the players, because they played in a manner leading up to the tournament, and then they come to the tournament and suddenly there's a, if you like, perhaps a degree of suppression on how they can express themselves on the field of play, because it's a tournament.
Well, I mean, there were three key elements of the game that were changed forever due to what came about in the aftermath of Italia 90. And I doubt anyone could argue that they haven't been good for football as both a participation or spectator sport. So we had the 3 points for a win at major tournaments. Italia 90, yes. It was still just two. The greatly reduced tolerance for aggressive tackling, even if subjectively it was deemed to be fair. And perhaps the most notable was the introduction of a new back pass rule that still exists today. That didn't come until after the Euro Championships in 1992, but Italia 90 was greatly responsible for that, due to the teams just simply shutting games down as a contest and a spectacle by repeatedly playing the ball between defenders and keeper just to run down the clock and frustrate opponents. What are your thoughts about these sort of three elements, Keith? And do you think FIFA went far enough with what they did in that period of Italia 90 and just after? And do you think there are any other laws that you think should have changed 30 years ago that would have benefited football a lot sooner?
I think, first of all, the back pass law, for me, is one of the best laws that's been introduced into football. It changed the entire dynamics. And I can remember that change vividly, because obviously I'm long in the tooth on the Football League at that particular time, and the Premier League, and sort of the Premier League wasn't there then, but I decided very clearly that how we would introduce this and how we would how it would impact. The impact was that the game just accelerated beyond belief, and all of a sudden we as referees, probably at that time all our training had been about endurance, because we were doing 9,500 meters in a game as an average. Yeah. And all of a sudden we got the dynamics of the keepers clearing the ball, and our running from end to end of the pitch meant that we were coming off pretty exhausted, and we were averaging then, I think it had gone up to something like 11,000 meters in some games.
Yeah.
And you wondered then whether you could actually do additional time, extra time. To understand that in context, we were amateur referees. I was a sales and marketing director, and so I had to cramp in a couple of training sessions and the games in a week.
Yeah.
And that was the catalyst. That particular law was the catalyst for me when I retired from refereeing in 95-96 to then go to the Premier League and say, look, as it was formed, I spent 2 years as a ref on the Premier League. Look, Mr. Sir Dave Richards, I had meetings with him and suggested that professional referees needed to be introduced.
Well, it's interesting you say about the distance that you run as a referee at that time being 10.5-11 kilometres. That's approximately the same distance that the players run during the game. And, you know, we're always hearing, well, for 20 or 30 years now, about how players are tired all the time because they're playing constantly and so on. You know, how much consideration are we giving referees who are running the same, if not more, than players throughout the game?
More. Because I mean, if you take someone like Mark Elsey, when I was his boss at the PGMOL, he would sometimes do 14,500-15,000 meters in a game. Wow. He covered every blade of grass. But the real impact was that we had to change. I brought in a sports scientist, I brought in a sports coach, nutritionalist into the PGMOL, because the dynamic had changed dramatically and our training had to change. And so we required fitter, more mobile, more athletic referees. As a consequence of that, people like Webb and Clattenburg made some massive strides. And all the training had changed from being endurance through the sports science to dynamic.
Yeah.
So we were concentrating on accelerated sprints, because we were then starting to measure accurately the distances covered, the speed profiles. And even when I was the boss, in the first 3 years that I was the boss, the actual speed of Premier League games went up by 40%. So this one change in the law had a very positive impact on the game. It speeded the process up. It stopped time delaying. The players had to be somewhat fitter. Their exhaustion level came in at an earlier schedule in the game itself. So it actually opened up. We started as players began to tire, then they started making errors.
Yeah.
So for me, the old background of that particular law, fantastic. It was a great, great change.
Yeah, I think that in conjunction with the 3 points for a win, which I think greatly enhanced it as an entertainment spectacle in the group stages of tournaments, it was fantastic. And of course, anything that reduces poor tackling, you know, good tackling is a good thing still, and it's a shame we don't see it, I think. But I think 1990, we were really just starting to see the tail end of the cynical tackling, weren't we? And I think there were some good innovations made around then to reduce that, you know, the tackle from behind being being more strictly monitored by referees. I think that was one of the key ones.
Yeah, I think even referees today with that aspect of the law, yeah, again, coaching referees, it's the one area that referees find difficult. They won't admit it, but they do, because, you know, there are three dynamics now to a challenge, and the first one is it a careless challenge? If it is, it's just a free kick. And then we have the other two, which is reckless, which is a yellow card, and excessive force, which is a red. And, you know, when you look at those three areas of a challenge, there's grey areas in between. Sometimes that reckless challenge does have pace, does have a dynamic, and it borders on red, but isn't quite there. And I think we often see referees now go for the yellow card too quick. And the impact of that is either they're weak on the second yellow card offences and inconsistent, or they actually jump to a second card and the player's off. No management. So that dynamic of that challenge was massive. And of course, the other one that then we saw come in was the denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity.
Yeah.
And that impacted on me personally, massively, because the law had been in for a season. Life was going along quite nicely for me. I was appointed to referee the semi-final between West Ham and Nottingham Forest at Aston Villa, and up to that point we'd been applying denial of an obvious goal scoring opportunity, and we'd been operating a criteria that said it only affects a red card if the challenge is cynical, because we'd based it on Willie Young's challenge in the Arsenal game, which was cynical, that brought a player down who was on his way to goal. So I'm there about to referee this game, three or four days away from refereeing West Ham Nottingham Forest, when we're called to a meeting at Coventry and we're told that the law and how we're interpreting the law on denial of an obvious goal scoring opportunity was incorrect. And we were told any foul, a simple foul that denies an obvious goal-scoring opportunity is a red card offence. And I was faced with Tony Gale making a challenge on Crosby, the Nottingham Forest forward, and I'm the first guy that's out on the field applying the new interpretation in England. The week before, Tony Gale would have had a bit of a talking to. He wouldn't have, if the free kick had been awarded, and a chat, and now I suddenly am thrusting a red card, and that absolutely ruined the game. And because the players hadn't been informed, the managers hadn't been informed, the media were not informed of a change in application of law, then I was the Aunt Sally. And that's why the laws of the game, as someone that's always practice the laws of the game, but also through the books I do with You Are the Ref with Paul Trevelyan, you know, the public coming in, asking questions and answering them. There I was, absolutely in the middle, and that's never been forgotten. West Ham fans will never forgive me for that particular incident, but I blame the authorities for making a law change mid-season, and fortunately they've never done that since. So referees makes life a little bit more easy for referees. So there's another law change that came in that probably on the face of it was too harsh. And then, of course, more recently, for an offence inside the penalty area where the goalkeeper or defender is making a genuine attempt to play the ball, with the triple jeopardy of a red card, a dismissal, if you like, a penalty kick, is cast to the winds, because we award the penalty kick and it's now a yellow card offence in that situation.
If you don't mind, I was just going to ask Keith a question regarding the back pass law. I mean, it's interesting, Keith, you mentioned that the 1990 World Cup is seen by many as a as a bit of a dull tournament, which I agree, I think it was. I think a lot of people gloss over the fact that there were some pretty dour games there, obviously because of England did well and the Gazza scenario and what have you. I just wondered how long in the pipeline was the back pass law sort of boiling, simmering up before they made this change? I mean, was it purely on the back of the 1990 World Cup, or was it something that was on the cards anyway in the next couple of years?
No, I think that the state of Italia 90 impacted on the lawmakers who needed to make a change. You know, up to that point, we'd had very negative play from the Italian international team. They just put a wall up, and some of their games were pretty boring, despite the fact that they got some dynamic and flair players. And then, of course, I think 90 was the emergence, really, of the emergence of the African nations cut into the tournament. And you know, I mean, I remember it because of Nessun Dorma. I mean, that's the thing that holds strong. But in terms of the back pass law, initially it still created some problems, because I can remember the winger going down and then reaching the goal line and cutting inside and passing to the goalkeeper from the goal line, if you like, on the goal line near the corner flag, making a pass to a goalkeeper who was yards off his line. And so when you blew to award an indirect free kick, people said, well, that's not a back pass, it came from the side. And so there are all these dynamics that put, not pressure, but these are the sort of questions raised. And then, you know, initially, I mean, the law was clear, but a lot of people couldn't understand why their head, or if you remember, the knee passes weren't penalised in the same way. Those became part of a discussion point at the time, but fortunately were put to bed. But it's a law that I think has had the biggest dynamic in terms of its change. We've obviously seen offside impact and change on a fairly frequent basis. But that really, you know, only impacts on the English game, because in Europe and in other parts of the world, they play with a sweeper who sits just on the edge of the penalty area, and the pressure on offsides is a lot less in those scenarios.
So in the balance of things, with these rule changes that we've discussed, the back pass and the tackle, the tackle rule there, I mean, who are the teams and the players that you can remember at the time were particularly difficult to officiate or to enforce these rules against? Was there any teams or any individuals that you felt caused you particular problems at the time?
Well, I don't think there were actual problems with the players themselves. The problems were the fact that I'm running towards one penalty area, having perhaps run 30, 40 yards in a sprint, and then I'm seeing the pass to the goalkeeper. I'm expecting this wide out pass that we see now frequently, with goalkeepers having to be footballers, because that's the other dynamic. You know, the other dynamic was some of the goalkeepers couldn't cope with these changes. You know, some of the goalkeepers literally were picking the ball up, and these were the crucial issues, and of course, they certainly impacted in terms of the dynamics for the referee. There were no real teams. I mean, some of the teams would play the ball long, and some took advantage of it. But yeah, Clearly the pressure went on to the goalkeepers to change their style. Most good goalkeepers play with their hands, of course. They suddenly had to play almost like defenders, and some were getting caught out. Some had not practiced that for a long time. And so in that situation, there were one or two major mistakes and goals resulting from back passes and goalkeepers getting themselves into trouble and then picking the ball up.
On the balance of things, Keith, what's your opinion? Was refereeing easier in 1990 than it is now?
Well, you know, when I refereed, okay, on the odd occasion we'd have 10 or more cameras, and at big tournaments obviously more. You know, when we take a simple Premier League game now, there's 22 cameras. And, you know, this is why I'm a strong supporter of any form of technology to help the referee. Look, the process of a referee is simple. First of all, they have to see. They then think, and they have to then react and then make a call. And so that process suddenly becomes exposed when the dynamic of the game has increased and you've now got, instead of three cameras, 22 cameras. They're seeing things that the referee's not seeing. As a result, he's missing incidents or he's getting incidents wrong. And the exposure to the referee is massive in the modern game. That's why I'm a supporter of VAR. That's why I'm absolutely critical, beyond becoming boring, about how we in England are applying that VAR system. Now, VAR will improve the process if we stick to the criteria of how it is operated.
Listeners' questions time, and we've just got a couple to squeeze in here for our panel, and we'll start this one with this one from at RM Mullen, and it's for Keith. He wants to know if officials are torn when they see their home nation progress, knowing that it can cost them possibly getting bigger matches later in a tournament.
No, I think, you know, we're all fans. I'm a massive fan of football. We want England team to do well. So as a result of that, you go to a tournament, you individually want to perform as well as possible. If you're given that honour of getting a final or getting a semi-final, then that's brilliant. But there's a disappointment if your own nation doesn't progress, because the impact of having a successful international team impacts greatly on competitions throughout the country at grassroots level right the way through. There's a positivity that comes out of it that, you know, from fans, from players, from everybody involved in the game. So I think the first line is we always want our international team to progress. If that fairly comes about, then if we're doing well in that tournament, we've got a chance of refereeing the final.
So the second question, and I'll put this one to Matthew, comes from at @Yad_Williams, and it's simply, was Ireland versus Egypt, one of the games we talked about earlier, actually the worst game of Italia 90?
In a word, yes. I mean, we obviously discussed this earlier on in the conversation, but I mean, it's difficult to say without analysing every game again, because I mean, many of these games have passed us by over the last three decades or so. But looking back at that one for the purposes of this discussion, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a game as dull as and with so few incidents as that one. I mean, I suppose you could say that group as a whole. I mean, there were some stinkers. I mean, there was. And again, they often involved Ireland. I mean, the Ireland England game, the first game of that group was pretty poor. But I suppose at least you could argue there are a couple of goals in it. But yeah, I think you'd be hard pressed without going back and watching every game again, which maybe I will do one day. I think you'd be hard pressed to think of a game that had that was as dull as that. Although I suppose you could say the World Cup final was a pretty poor game. Yeah. Again, I mean, I said this when I mentioned the question to Keith. Yeah, I do think a lot of this tournament was glossed over because of the impact that England doing well had and the Gaza effect and Nessun Dorma. I mean, there did seem to be quite a few games that were poor, and this. The Egypt Ireland one was certainly one, and the World Cup final sort of encapsulated that, really. And I do think from the changes that we've discussed here, the change to the back pass rule and tackling and cynical fouls, I think we saw the results almost instantly 4 years later at USA 94. I think the football was a lot more fast flowing. I think the games were more entertaining. So for the better, I think. But yeah, in answer to the question, I think the Ireland-Egypt game was probably the worst game of the World Cup for me, certainly.
Yeah, from not the group of death, but the group of deathly boredom.
Yes, yeah. Well, I seem to remember it got to a stage where I think at one point they were thinking of drawing lots, weren't they, for who was going to go through from this group, because it was a draw, another draw. I think there was a series of draws, and there was a scenario at the end where if results went a certain way, they'd have had to draw lots to see who qualified. So I think that sums up the state of that group, and possibly the tournament as well, being slightly controversial.
Finally, it's trivia time again. Luis Suarez, no, not that one, was Spain's head coach at Italia 90. He had a glittering playing career which featured long and successful stints with the great Barcelona side of the 1950s and Heleno Herrera's Grande Inter of the 1960s. Incredibly, he is still the only Spanish-born player to have won the Ballon d'Or. One of his chief rivals and contemporaries, Real Madrid legend Alfredo Di Stefano, won the award twice, but only after he'd gained Spanish citizenship and began playing for his adopted homeland. He'd previously played international football for his native Argentina and then Colombia. Suarez was a member of the only Spanish side to have won a major tournament up to this point, the 1964 European Championships. And with that, another episode comes to a close. I hope you've enjoyed listening to our esteemed guests. Keith Hackett could be found on Twitter at HackettRef to talk all things refereeing. Ash Rose, a pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's a pleasure talking all Italia 90. It's great to be back there.
So where can our listeners who don't know about Alive and Kicking get their 90s football fix with your podcast and social media?
They can follow us at AK90s, where the pod is hopefully as weekly as it can be, and we're always tweeting 90s bits and bobs, and you can follow myself, which pretty much does the same, at AshRoseUK as well.
Matthew, Chris, thanks for being here, mate. And your Twitter, please?
Yeah, it's at Matthew J. Christ on Twitter, the same as my Instagram account, which annoys several people we know because it's the same address.
It's all about the brand. It's all about the brand.
Good. Make sure you get over to Matthew's Twitter because he shares a lot of his 90s related football features and 80s, which of course he's already admitted to being a big nerd for. All the nostalgia stuff is there is great, and I'm sure you'll all appreciate that. I know you know, but we are on Twitter and Instagram too, at VinceR90. That's VINCERA. If your Italian isn't that good. If you'd like to say hello and share any Italia 90 memories that you want to. Do come back next time, won't you? Because we'll be bringing Group B to a close by saying Das Verdania forever to the Soviet Union, and both Argentina and Romania fight to save themselves from elimination. Ciao!